Okay. Soon, you'll be listening to the next episode of the Ninja Consultant podcast. But first, I wanted to say a word about our previous episode, not the Christmas Boat one, but the one where we interviewed Caleb Dunaway. Uh-oh. There, okay. The computer stopped up for a second. So, it was a frustrating interview, to say the least, but there were a couple... There were more than a few problems where this was the first time I had ever met Caleb, and obviously his first convention, and he was really nervous and kind of perplexed, and I don't think he really wanted to agree to do an interview about Moe at all, and we sort of, like, forced him into it, because this is, like, the only person I know who's, like, into it at all.
Nobody forced him.
Nobody forced him.
We didn't put a gun to his head.
It's true.
And say, you must
be interviewed. He was kind of, you know, against the whole idea. And so, as a consequence, he didn't really... He's a nice enough person, but he just didn't answer any of our questions. Because he was... I think he was really nervous about the internet's perception of him, or having the internet mad at him, or getting...
Yeah, nobody likes that.
Right.
I'm sympathetic.
That you also don't want to get a lot of hate mail?
I don't want the internet mad at me either.
Sometimes I don't mind, and other times I'm like, oh no, the internet is mad at me. But... The internet is the internet. There are angry people on it all the time.
Haters gonna hate.
Haters gonna hate. So anyway, I met someone from Japanator the other day, and they were like, oh, my other friend at Japanator like would be perfectly willing to be interviewed about Moe on your show, and he'll answer any question. So maybe we'll interview that guy eventually after I get in touch with him. But the Anime News Network Shelf Life column is taking up a ton of my time, so we hardly have time for podcasts like this.
We're watching so much stuff.
Yeah.
All in a row.
Yeah. Rather a lot of it. Okay, so now on to the long-awaited Black Lagoon episode.
Or the intro to the long-awaited Black Lagoon episode. So this is the preface.
Yeah.
Then you'll get the intro.
Right.
Then you'll get the first part of the Black Lagoon
show. The first part is actually about Ghost in the Shell, Sanon Complex, and then the second part is about Black Lagoon,
which we also reiterate in the intro, to which this is the preface.
Right, so there are at least three introductions saying pretty much the same thing.
Maybe we should put in a foreword too.
Right, the foreword should be by someone else.
Oh, you're right.
All right. So, welcome to possibly episode 75 of the Ninja Consultant Podcast.
Depending on how you want to count it.
Our long-awaited Black Lagoon show.
Oh, God.
You can't see his face, but Noah's...
This podcast is never going to end. It's going to hang over my head for the rest of eternity.
Now you're too loud.
I'm sorry.
You didn't talk that loud during the
test. No, I'll be quieter.
Okay, so should we explain why has there been such a delay, indeed a delay of 6 months, in putting this show up?
Oh, man, because this show is really hard. Like... I really decided to take on way, way too much information. And then I was afraid that people were going to think that I was a bad person because I have these opinions. And so then I was nervous about posting it for that reason. And then I realized that a lot of the things that I said were kind of, I don't know, rambling and inaccurate. And it's just so hard. Like, this is... two or three semesters worth of political science, not that I've ever taken political science, but crammed into one show about two titles that, I don't know, I do think they're relevant, and I do think that they're relevant in the way that I put forth in the show. It's just, there's so much background that you have to get through in order to appreciate the connection. I didn't do a very good job. Getting there.
But I think you're making this way more complicated than it is. It's really because this show covers a lot of really political topics, and Noah is afraid of losing all our friends based on his unpopular political
views.
Well,
no, I think that we've already lost all our friends based on those unpopular political views.
What? Really?
I mean, yeah.
Who's unfriended me?
Everyone.
What?
You just don't know it.
Oh!
Sorry.
So then it doesn't matter if we post the show or not. How long has that been the case?
Hooray. About... a year.
What? When did I stop having friends?
Sorry, dude.
Whatever. All right. So I think we're going to, because we're recording this now in January of 2010, but I think we're going to put in parts of the original recording and then occasionally stop it and explain or delete them or whatever.
Right.
So or we'll jump in and say like, hey, now it's us in the future and this part was wrong.
Right. So to let you know where we're going, I'm going to outline this show right now because I listened to it today and it is broad.
Oh,
but
well,
at the very least, I want to provide benchmarks, well, an index, if you will.
Well, then let me stop and save it just in case I have that crazy audio problem.
Oh, okay.
Say your index.
All right. So in the first half of the show, I explain how the rise of terrorism, specifically Islamic terrorism, as we've come to know it today, relates to the standalone complex in Ghost in the Shell, and how Ghost in the Shell is sort of a reflection on both the causes and solutions to what I see as a real fundamental problem in sort of the concept of civilization in the 21st century. In the second half, I talk about how the concepts of fourth generation warfare apply to the world that's created in Black Lagoon, both in the text and sort of in the subtext, as well as how it reflects sort of an aspect of the world that we don't usually see or think about as Americans. I know that there are certainly some international listeners, but let's just say that we tend not to think about them as residents of the first world.
We don't think of people who live here as residents of the first world? Oh, our international
listeners. We don't tend to think of the issues addressed in Black Lagoon as residents of the first world.
Oh, okay. Is that it?
Yeah, that's my summary.
Okay. So now we'll go back to the past and listen to that part of the show. Is it going to get really political?
It is, by nature, a political topic. That topic not being politics, but being
history,
history and ideology and warfare. Yeah, I guess you could say it's political.
Okay.
I'll also be potentially bringing in authorities who are somewhat controversial, perhaps, just because I might mention them or talk about them or advance some of their theories doesn't necessarily mean that I agree with them 100%, just to put that out there.
Fair enough. Okay, I'm going to let Noah do most of the talking in this show, but I will try to jump in periodically with questions that I think the layman would have.
Indeed.
Because I don't always know what you're talking about,
right?
And there's no reason to think that most people would.
Well, I don't always know what I'm talking about either, and there is a lot involved here, and it's a broad topic, and I'm not entirely certain that all of this is going to make sense. But we'll do the best we can, and hopefully I won't get too much wrong. This will be a podcast with fairly extensive show notes, sources.
You actually write them?
Yeah.
Okay, because I was looking back through our archive, and I noticed that...
Yeah, there's plenty of shows that I have not written notes for.
Claim they're going to have notes,
yeah,
and they don't.
But those show notes are a matter of geekery.
Right, and not necessarily...
These show notes have more to do with sourcing your theories and evidence and stuff like that.
Right, proving you're not just some nut job on the internet.
Right, well...
You're a well-sourced nut job on the internet.
Look.
Yes, go ahead.
Today, we're going to talk about terrorism. And we're going to talk about the aspects of this that make it, I think, the fundamental question of the 21st century right now, above and beyond global economic collapse, which is not a...
When are we
going to
have
new
our
phenomenon.
Economy show?
Huh?
When are we going to have our economy show?
Oh, yeah, because you really want
I'm
listeners
talk
to
about,
dwindle.
The Japanese economic recession of the...
Oh, yeah,
90s.
Well, we could. That would be an interesting show to talk about how anime and manga reacted to that.
Yeah.
Like that show, what was it, Nioranga had
an
entire episode devoted to explaining the Japanese banking crisis.
Yeah, I also think it plays a lot in Hikari Kano. There are a lot of, in their charts and graphs recaps. They talk about the recession a lot.
That's true. I forgot about that. But that's
anyway.
Not this show.
Right.
This show is about standalone complex, which I think deals with issues that arose after September 11th in a way that I found to be better than just about any other text I'm not suggesting.
Is it the first season? Because I think I believe you. The second season might be.
Well, I'm not suggesting.
Okay, you're saying the topics in the fiction.
The topic of standalone complex, and it's not as though global terrorism suddenly appeared.
Right, it had always been there
on September 11th. Well, it hadn't always been there. But I'm not going to give a history of global terrorism at the moment.
All right.
You know, up until now. Instead, I'm going to say that for us in America, it became a very important topic for us to consider in terms of national defense. And so what I mean when I say that terrorism is the first and foremost question of the 21st century, I mean that you have this is a fairly new phenomenon where young men take it upon themselves to strap bombs to their bodies and detonate them against non-military targets and military targets.
Right.
But essentially, committing acts of suicide, mass murder.
So, for a historical comparison, that's different from, like, the Crusades, because it's not fought by individuals, right?
Well,
because it's like young men going to murder some dudes for semi-religious reasons.
Jumping ahead a little bit, but yeah. Ghost in the Shell standalone complex deals with, and the idea of the standalone complex is that you have an event that triggers copycat
activities.
Like in The Laughing Man.
Right, where there are other people start taking over The Laughing Man's gig.
Essentially.
Right, where, to summarize for people who haven't seen it, and you should, if there was a page on our site of recommended anime, that would be
it's
on there.
Very good.
The Laughing Man commits a hacking, like he hacks something really publicly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the problem is, several years later, there are more Laughing Man cases that happen, but there's a big question in the first season of the show as to whether or not it's the Laughing Man committing them or a copycat.
Right.
Which happens a lot, like, in terms of serial killers on that kind of show, on, like, crime dramas. Okay.
So, the standalone complex is a postmodern phenomenon that deals a lot with mass communication that we now have. We now have the ability to project events all over the place. People are constantly bombarded by images, media events all the time. And so these things get writ large in the human psyche. Essentially, people becoming radicalized.
Okay.
Independent of each other.
Because of the mass media?
Because of mass media, you have individuals who find themselves otherwise adrift because their large ideological movements have essentially been relegated to the dustbin of history. You no longer really have the promise of some kind of global communist revolution.
Is that your example? Can you give an example?
Of what?
What you're talking about. Because I'm having a hard time following what's in the dustbin of history now?
Well, you have this concept that was put forth by Francis Fukuyama in the late 90s, talked about the end of history.
Mm-hmm.
This was after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when capitalism prevailed and communism failed.
Okay.
There was no longer a promise for some kind of utopia. There was no longer, because it had failed, and what we were left with was capitalism.
No. Right.
Capitalism simply functioned.
Okay.
And it was difficult for people to argue contrary to that.
Okay.
Because
the
United States and its allies.
If you were waiting for the communist revolution, it's over.
It failed.
Okay.
Along with that, you have the sort of Nietzschean death of God, whereby religion no longer holds the sort of universal grip that it once did.
And this is all put forth by that guy whose name you just said?
Well,
the Japanese guy?
Fukuyama?
Yeah.
I don't know how much Fukuyama talked about religion specifically.
Okay.
But you have a state of being where people are at a loss to find causes larger than themselves to fight for.
Okay.
And so, as a result, they kind of drift in a state of alienation.
Mm.
This is something that the postmoderns talk about a lot,
where
they have a fragmented identity of anime, I believe, is what, not like anime, anime.
Like a sea anemone?
That Sartre talked about.
Can you spell that?
A-N-O-M-I-E.
And what does it mean?
contemporary English language is a sociological term that signifies in individuals an erosion, diminution, or absence of personal norms, standards, or values, and increased states of psychological normlessness.
Oh, it sounds like Hikikomori style.
It does sound very much like Hikikomori style, and you can look at Hikikomori as being something of a postmodern phenomenon as well. And Hikikomori are very much the types who are susceptible, I guess, to this sort of standalone complex. Specifically when dealing with terrorism, you have people who are radicalized, and depending on where they're from, they get radicalized in different ways. It is largely a technological phenomenon because the anime exists in these people, and they use the internet to find other like-minded individuals who, I don't want to say benevolent form, but in its most benign form, I guess, is something like 4chan, and in its most malevolent form,
it's also like 4chan.
Well, no, it is
2chan,
Al-Qaeda's global reach. So you have specifically Muslims who feel as though they have no place. Globalization's reach has made it essentially impossible, no matter where you are, anywhere on the planet, to get away from American mass culture. American mass culture having certain distinct values of capitalism and openness and sexuality.
Can I add that from a film school perspective, it's that kind of thing, like the reach of American film into the most ridiculous of obscure countries that would never have seen them. For me, that's like a triumph of marketing channels, but it has the unintended consequence of causing some kinds of radicalization, where because your market saturation is so great, you reach people who are like, I don't really like the values of your culture, but that's what we put on TV because our country has no marketing channels
and
of our own.
Indeed, many of the people want to consume it.
Yeah, and
if it was universally rejected.
Well, Hollywood films are made to be very likable.
By the
widest audience possible. Yeah, so of course, most people would want to watch a big Hollywood film.
But when the values being presented are contrary to the values of the society in which
it's being shown.
Yeah.
That film is Easy Rider.
No, exist. Well, that film is, depending on where you are, practically anything.
Every film.
That gets produced. But because technology has made the world smaller, you no longer really have the ability to keep it out.
Yeah.
Even in North Korea, probably the most closed regime on the planet.
Yeah, the dictator watches a lot of American movies.
Well, the dictator does, but people are forbidden from consuming anything that is not North Korean approved.
Yeah.
And yet
they smuggle it in.
Inasmuch as they are becoming radicalized against the dictatorship, it's because they're getting those videotapes of South Korean soap operas.
like the Winter Tale?
And Winter Sonata, which shows them that the world is not as Dear Leader suggests that it is.
And some other Koreans are like super rich by comparison and leading awesome lives.
And it's precisely because it's so difficult to control the global reach of technology. In college, I had an anthropology professor who said that the internet is spreading faster than plumbing. And so, as a result, to keep a society closed is ever more difficult. And for those who have a lot to lose by creating an open society, they are going to fight back. And so, back to standalone complex. You have a situation where people who are adrift in society become radicalized by finding a cause they can fight for. And this is difficult as sort of a law enforcement problem. It's difficult to deal with because it's a highly decentralized occurrence. There is no leadership. It happens spontaneously, and little terrorist cells kind of emerge, as they do in Standalone Complex. In Second Gig, you have the individual 11 mm-hmm. who, as it turns out, they were not acting of their own free will exactly, but they certainly believed that they were. And so how do you fight an opponent who looks exactly like everyone else, mm-hmm. has no real common background or identity necessarily?
Uh-huh.
Because, as I said, I mean, most of the terrorism in the world, not all of it, is Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can say, well, those with a Muslim background might be more, have a higher chance of being radicalized. But then there's a only, of all Muslims, only a tiny, tiny percentage gets radicalized.
Mm.
And how do you then deal with that without angering everyone else who would not otherwise be against you?
Mm-hmm.
So what you have in Ghost in the Shell, you have Section 9, which is an elite organization, but more than that, they are flexible and have a similarly self-directed approach. That is to say, Major Kusanagi makes a lot of snap decisions,
mm-hmm.
and she doesn't have to check in with the higher-ups. The way that most state-run bureaucracy works, if yeah. not indeed, you know, part of the nature of bureaucracy, is that you send information up the chain to the decision makers, who then relay that information back down the chain. But by the time you've done that, your terrorists have already done what they're going to do and have left.
Mm.
So this is the problem that we face. Now, in 2003,
mm-hmm.
the United States military went into Iraq to knock over a regime and hopefully give the Iraqi people the opportunity to establish a democratic government. As we all know now, it didn't work out quite as planned.
Right.
And this highlights what we now kind of have as an object lesson in asymmetrical warfare.
Okay.
Asymmetrical because you have a large state-driven entity, which is well-funded and kind of a Goliath. You have, and quite literally, you have heavily armored soldiers rolling through town in giant military vehicles.
In the world's most sophisticated tanks.
Indeed.
Do you mean just horribly uneven warfare?
Well, yeah, horribly uneven.
Is asymmetrical.
Asymmetrical, okay. Right?
Yeah.
Fighting a bunch of guys with Kalashnikov rifles.
Well, I think it's important to say, well, do you mean like, okay, because I think the question of who we were fighting changed drastically, like once we knocked over
Hussein's regime. Yes, and indeed we...
Because then there's the real question, like the war is still going, but then who are you fighting?
Ah, and this is, and because it's not an easy question to answer, it's kind of why I'm even having difficulty discussing the issue.
Right.
In the Second World War, we could say
we defeated this enemy government. And,
well, you yeah. have the propaganda films, Why We Fight.
Yes.
It is much more difficult now to explain why we fight.
Right.
As a result, our opponents know exactly why they fight. They're fighting because they've been occupied. They're fighting because they...
Who are the opponents? Like, the news calls them insurgents. Who are insurgents? How do you know?
They are really diverse individuals.
They don't wear uniforms for an organization to which they belong.
They don't. And that's why it's helpful to look at them in terms of a theory of generational warfare. This being the fourth generation. The first three, don't worry about them.
No, you need to explain what they are.
Well,
or just in really brief.
I think
that's really important to this show.
I will.
Okay.
But
when you get to the Black Lagoon part?
It's no. First through third generation warfare deals with states fighting states.
Okay.
Fourth generation warfare is different because it involves a state fighting a stateless entity.
Okay.
And this has been around forever. You shouldn't think of it in terms of some kind of progression, although it's called, you know, first through fourth generation warfare, right?
Right.
But each of these generations has existed in one way or another at different times, periods of time in history.
Okay.
You have in the Roman times, you have the Spartacus slave uprising.
Mm-hmm.
That was fourth generation warfare. It was a bunch of slaves against the Romans. The Romans were heavily armored, highly outfitted, trained for troop-to-troop combat.
Yeah.
While the slaves were essentially guerrilla fighters.
Yeah.
And
unarmored.
So when we were fighting the Soviets,
yeah,
the question of who wins the battle,
yeah,
is one that can be answered in terms of materiel.
During the Cold War.
Yeah. And World War II as well. Who has the best logistics? Who has the most nimble tanks? You know, who has the better weaponry, who has the better training,
mm-hmm,
for combat. And when you sit down to play any of the games on the market, or like the turn-based strategy games,
mm-hmm,
you're dealing within the paradigm of first through third generation warfare.
Name one game?
All the ones that I know are from the days of my misspent youth. That's, I don't know what they're
called now.
That's
fine.
Tell
the people listeners.
Well, so...
Because I need to know... examples.
What the hell was it called? General? The Perfect General? Perfect General, I think, was the name of the game.
Is it a tabletop game?
No, it was a computer game.
Okay.
And...
For the Amiga?
Yeah, it was on the Amiga. I think it was not just for the Amiga.
Okay.
But you also have games like StarCraft and any game that's sort of resource based,
uh-huh,
in the way that you upgrade your production to produce soldiers and fighters and then send them into battle against each other. That's first through third generation warfare.
Okay.
Essentially. Fourth generation warfare is different because it's not fought at the level of materiel. It's fought at an ideological level.
Okay.
How is it possible that we go in with so much weaponry,
uh-huh,
and win every encounter with insurgents,
yeah,
essentially, and can't defeat them?
Mm.
And this was how we lost Vietnam, essentially.
Right.
Is that the opponent controls the moral level, mm, the ideological level.
So it's what they call in the news the battle of the hearts and minds.
Hearts and minds, but that term is kind of, it's a little deceptive, I guess.
Okay.
Because...
I mean, we recently saw the Watchmen film.
Yes.
And in the Watchmen, they present an alternate ending to the Vietnam War and an alternate history where Dr. Manhattan shows up and the Viet Cong start kind of worshipping him as a god.
Yeah, yeah.
In that case, they've won some kind of mind battle.
And in fact, I don't think that would have worked.
In real life?
In real life. I think that even if we had had Dr. Manhattan on our side doing what he was doing, I suppose, yeah, if you're facing down a god, maybe you can, you kind of lose all hope for your side. But really, in fighting American forces,
uh-huh,
you kind of are fighting a god. You're fighting a massive force that can well overpower you. It might not necessarily have been true in Vietnam, mm-hmm, as the Viet Cong were fairly well funded themselves.
Yeah.
But certainly today,
yeah,
you have no chance. The only thing you can hope to do of winning tactically, you can only win strategically by outlasting, by getting the people in the state that military represents.
Uh-huh.
To withdraw those forces by making it too bloody. And you can make it too bloody by inflicting sufficient casualties, which don't even need to necessarily be that great.
Uh-huh.
As we, at no point was there a body count of any real measurable percentage of the armed forces in Iraq.
Okay.
We're talking about a fraction of a percentage of the armed forces being killed.
Of which side?
Of our side.
Okay.
Of Americans and British.
Yeah.
And that was still bloody enough for Americans to demand withdrawal.
Okay. Oh, the public was like, that's still too deadly.
Right. and Americans care about Americans.
Right.
Because when we did pull out of Vietnam in 1973, it was just
in a body
few
bag.
Short years before the North completely overran the South, creating hundreds of thousands of refugees and 400,000 some odd dead bodies that we just abandoned.
Right.
Public sentiment was not terribly interested in that fact.
Right, because for that particular generation of young men, it's kind of like, you know, all my friends' dads have a story about how they didn't get called to the draft, or they avoided the draft, or they weren't eligible to fight, because everyone else, it seemed like, ended up dead. I mean, that's ridiculous. Like, that might be like a ridiculous statement, but
well, there was
a public conception that, I mean, and that may have been a misconception, that it was an incredibly deadly war.
Well, no, it certainly was an incredibly deadly war.
That they were, that a whole generation of young men was ending up dead or traumatized.
Traumatized, certainly.
Yeah.
And yes, there were significant deaths and very significant casualties.
Right.
But
the Iraq War is different because the body count's much lower. People are more likely to come back with a limb missing and some traumatic.
Right. Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, or brain injuries.
Although it irritates me because, yes, to a certain extent, it's only being recognized by hospitals, you know, by the establishment now.
Yeah.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right, but that was always a problem throughout history.
It has always existed.
We just didn't believe in psychology until 100 years ago.
Well, we didn't believe in psychology, but it's also true that part of the problem of being a soldier in America in particular right now is that there is really, we have a very ambivalent relationship. I wouldn't even say ambivalent. We Americans,
right,
who are not, you know, from red states, I guess,
yeah,
typically, have a very poor relationship, really, with the idea of an armed forces.
Yeah.
In no small part because of Vietnam, soldiers have been made out to look like crazed killers.
Mm.
And when I first started to really read first-person reporting from Iraq, I was kind of surprised to discover that many of the officers in particular were really intelligent, incredibly moral, amazingly upstanding individuals.
Mm.
And all it took for the Iraq War to pretty much be delegitimized in everyone's eyes was the Abu Ghraib incident, where people were tortured and humiliated.
But people were against the war before that.
People were against the war, but this is where I'm saying
the war
was lost on the basis of the moral level.
Right.
Where we were not acting as liberators, we were acting as conquerors.
Yeah.
And no single incident radicalized more people
than those photographs.
Because the American war establishment didn't understand and then would continue not to understand until about 2005, 2006. So the war was going on for 3 years before people really understood what it means to fight a stateless entity, where when you burst through someone's door to arrest a terrorist, you end up frightening the guy's family and creating property damage. And if they didn't hate you before, sure as hell hate you now.
Right. Now you created some more terrorists.
So, precisely.
Good job.
You've created more terrorists.